So for this final lecture, I'm going to talk about gravitational instantons. And these are processes, non-perturbative processes in gravity that are quantum mechanical in nature. And it's basically about tunneling. And I think tunneling is one of the most startling examples, really, of quantum mechanics in action. We know it happens, and we have sort of various different ways of describing it. We can describe it intuitively as, you know, a particle borrows energy to jump across a barrier, or we can describe it by thinking about wave functions, like in a Schrödinger equation type of approach. But the fact remains that classically, if we don't have enough energy, we hit a barrier higher than our energy, we cannot get past it. We get reflected off. Whereas quantum mechanically, it's possible, albeit with a low probability, to actually go through. So it's how, you know, how do we have a sort of mechanism or different ways of understanding it intuitively, but how do we go about calculating it? And so today I wanted to spend the bulk of the time deconstructing these two papers by Coleman and Coleman de Lucia, in which the process of decay in quantum field theory is considered. And this leads us to gravitational instantons. And an instanton is a solution to Euclidean field equations. And this sort of incorporation of the word instant is the fact that it only sort of, it exists, it's ephemeral, it's localized in Euclidean time. So how we get to that Euclidean process, it's really a calculational tool, but I want to start by just motivating this calculational approach by thinking about standard 1+1-dimensional quantum mechanics and looking at the first time we typically meet tunneling. So well, actually, I'm not going to write the equation. Let me call it Schrödinger tunneling. So we have this picture of a barrier. We make it nice and clean because we're going to solve exactly. And we have some ingoing flux of particles, some out, some of which are reflected and some of which get transmitted. And we solve the Schrödinger equation in each of these two regimes. Out here, we find sort of oscillatory or real solutions. And under the barrier, we find exponential or Euclidean type of solutions. And when we do the calculation, we find that mod t squared . So here, our particle's energy is E, and the height of the barrier is V naught. So if V naught is less than E, we know that we do not have a sort of standard oscillatory type of solution under the barrier, but we know we've got two exponentials. We match our wave functions at each edge and their derivatives, and that's what we get, where it's normalized to unit incoming flux. So here, I'm telling you what it is in terms of the full Schrödinger equation, but then I'm going to sort of set m to 1 and h bar to 1. And so this is, if you like, a complex frequency or an imaginary frequency. And omega d we could write as the integral from 0 to d So it's that sort of trivial here, but you know, integral from 0 to d dx gives us d, and root 2 delta v is our omega. So that's kind of just setting up a situation where we know exactly what's happening, even if it's a non-relativistic wave equation. So how else could I have got to that? Well, I want to just now say, let's just imagine that we turn our potential over, but I'm now going to say that this here is V naught minus E. So this is like delta V. And I'm going to ask, what happens if I have a little classical sort of marble or something, and I drop it? It's going to pick up a half a kinetic energy, which has the same magnitude as this potential difference. It's going to run along the bottom. It's going to hop back up and then maybe go back again. But crudely speaking, you get this sort of picture that the kinetic energy at the bottom will be this difference, delta V, during the transit. So this integral here I can replace my dx with an x dot dt. I can replace my x dot with root 2 delta v. And then I can replace one of those delta v's with a half x dot squared. And so what I end up with is kind of an action, or it looks like a Lagrangian, except it's not the sort of standard Lagrangian of kinetic minus potential. Here it's kinetic plus potential, so that's actually Euclidean rather than Lorentzian. You're sort of sending t goes to I tau. So strictly, perhaps, I should have labeled these as taus, because this thing looks like a Euclidean action. Now, this is just all very hand-wavy, but what it's doing is just trying to communicate that quite often we sort of have a bit of motion that we consider as real. That's where we have sort of normal behavior of the wave function. We hit a barrier where essentially we shouldn't be in some way. And a way of calculating what happens is to analytically continue to Euclidean time, which inverts the potential. So,
Omega squared is 2 delta V. So when we write omega d, why don't we take minus root, like the integration of minus the square root, because then maybe we'll get the Lagrangian where we have kinetic minus potential.
So here delta V is positive, yeah? So I'm not quite sure. I mean, I can't, I don't want something imaginary. I need.
I'm saying about omega D, you have defined that to be the integral over dx under root 2 delta v. Could have been minus dx integral because omega.
No, but this has to be positive, because this is telling you about the barrier. This is telling you about the resistance, if you like, that you've got to tunnel through. This has to be positive because your exponential here is negative. So tunneling is a very unlikely process, but it happens. And typically what we, you know, this exponential here is sort of indicative that it's some non-perturbative process. So we know that, you know, for example, radioactive decay is a tunneling process. And so we have this characteristic exponential half-life. You know, we have this notion of how long does it take for half of the atoms to decay, yeah? So it's that same sort of pattern here. So in general, what do I mean by that? This would be, say, like the locally looking this at the potential for the for alpha decay in radioactivity, and you might be starting here where it's sort of it's bound, but there is a lower energy state, and so what we're saying is you invert that. Here's where you start. You have a sort of classical motion to this exit point, and then it goes back again, which is why they used to call it a bounce in the 70s. So here I've just sketched some one-dimensional picture, but this picture was generalized by Banks, Bender, and Wu to a multi-dimensional sort of tunneling, and they got this notion of a most probable escape path, which was where you'd kind of look for a sort of saddle point of trajectories to kind of get in Euclidean space to get to this exit point. So,
can I ask a question?
Yeah.
As delta V, as you go from a thing that goes like this to a thing that goes from up to down.
I won't do it right.
Delta V changes sign from positive to negative.
So in this case, I mean, over here, the delta V just is what it is because it's, you know, it's just a box. Now here you don't. Here you're now looking at the Euclidean. You'd analytically continue, and you'd be looking at, in that case, you'd be looking at a half x dot squared plus v of x, right? So you're inverting your potential. You're now looking at classical motion in that potential well. So it's not as clean as it's not going to be just two, you know, 2 delta V times D or whatever, root 2 delta V times D, because your barrier is now not uniform. But it's like, it's the same, it's the sort of same concept. You're looking at how much of a barrier is there. So you're doing some integral through a barrier, but what you're actually integrating is this Euclidean action. And this encodes the saddle point. This is the sort of easiest route for either the particle or, as we're about to go to, a field to exit from a situation which is not a minimum energy state. So it's, you know, this is really more just motivating, if you like, why you do this in Euclidean space. But this picture of Euclideanizing, solving Euclidean. So the picture is T goes to I tau, and then you solve equations of motion. So that's kind of the step. You then compute the action. And this gives the leading order, which is the exponential contribution. So that's the method. And in the 70s, there was a sort of general, you know, first of all, there was this long drive to understand particle physics and the standard model, and things were getting extremely clear during the 70s, and there was this realization that what you mean by the vacuum might not be, you know, might be something a little more subtle, so that the vacuum can have structure. So, I mean, that underlies the standard model, the fact that our vacuum is more nuanced, and where we are in the vacuum, our symmetry breaking determines what our particle spectrum is, what the masses are. And so here, if we translate this to field theory, so we have this notion that we know we've got one scalar field, the Higgs. We have these scalars that are kind of determining, they're orchestrating, if you like, our whole theory of particle physics. But they also tell us about what the vacuum is and what the energy of the vacuum is. And, you know, we usually take it to be zero currently, but, you know, when we're talking about the very early universe, we talk about inflation, and that's where we have a scalar field that has some significant vacuum energy that drives accelerated expansion. And so here, the picture, this was what people were thinking of back in the 70s. And so there was this sort of idea, what happens if you have just some scalar field that has two local minima, but one is higher than the other. And for some reason, we happen to be in this configuration. And then this local minimum, we actually call the false vacuum, hence state of the false vacuum. And the reason is that it almost looks like a vacuum, in that if you're just looking over short times, the amplitude for shifting or tunneling through is always very exponentially suppressed. So if you look at short times, you won't necessarily notice this other vacuum because the probability of going there is very small. And so you can quantize around this vacuum, and you're almost fooled into thinking it's a real vacuum. So that's why it gets called a false vacuum. And in this picture, this would be the true vacuum, because it is the global minimum in this simple sketch. So, for example, you might have something like this. Where we have something familiar, which is giving you the overall shape of the potential, that's giving you the sort of double well. And then there's just a little bit of a tilt to make one vacuum lower than the other. So here, this would be phi is eta. That would be the true vacuum. And that would have V is zero, say. And phi equaled minus eta, that would be the false vacuum. And that would be V would be epsilon. So let's just think a little bit about, before I sort of say how Coleman did the calculation, I'm just going to sort of give a sketch of what happens, but there's a question first.
Is this a diagram for the Higgs potential at a fixed, at a particular energy scale, or is it?
This isn't the Higgs potential. So, no, this is just the type of, this is a potential I want to play with, okay, to try and describe what happens. You know, the Higgs is not a real scalar. Even Higgs's original model was not a real scalar. So, but I mean, actually, broadly, you know, the Higgs does have this. You know, you would write it as, or it is written as lambda of h or v, whatever. You might write it like that. Okay. So yeah, this is not. This is just toy. And then you would compute that self-coupling. and compute radiative corrections. Come back to that. Okay, so let's just think about what might happen if we go back to our intuitive picture of a particle banging against a wall. Yep.
One question with respect to this, because the normal or easy Higgs mechanism that we studied, the potential is, it has always like a discrete parity symmetry, but if now you have two vacuums, it doesn't. So I don't understand how symmetry breaking would work here, or is not what we have to think about.
No, we're not thinking about it, don't worry. I mean, here, the fact that I haven't given you an origin for phi, I haven't really said where the zero is, except when I wrote it there, indicates that the details of where you are, you know, how I draw my axes on this are really quite irrelevant. What's relevant is there's a local and a global minimum in what, for our discussion. We can come back to that line of thought later. So let's go back to thinking of just about a particle hitting a wall and borrowing energy. Let's suppose, what's the equivalent of that here? We have this, a whole, you know, our space is in this false vacuum. And so we might imagine that a bubble of true vacuum just fluctuates into existence. It borrows energy and does this, sort of just appears. What could happen? Well, if this bubble is too small, it's going to, if we think about what the energetics of this are, we've got a wall here with sigma energy per unit area. And inside the true vacuum, we've got a volume not at epsilon. So we can see that there's an energy budget here because the wall itself has energy, and we can think of that as the field has to get from here to here. Therefore, there's a, you know, it's got both gradient as well as potential energy. So we know that the boundary of the bubble has some energy per unit area. And then inside the bubble, you're no longer in the false vacuum, so you've gained some energy. So there's a sort of energy competition going on. If this bubble is too small, the surface area to volume ratio gets too high, and it'll recollapse. And if it's too big, then I would say, you know, you think of it as being too hard to form because this has to borrow energy to fluctuate into existence. So this kind of gives you the notion that there's a sort of just right size where it's not too small to recollapse and it's not sort of too expensive to form. So if we put some numbers to this, so we analytically continue to Euclidean space and do this budget for the bubble, then the wall, the cost of the wall, so that's going to be the surface area, but we've now got the surface area of the three sphere. So that's 2 pi squared r cubed times this sigma. So I'm saying my bubble has radius r. And then we've got the energy gain. Which is the volume inside, which is pi squared over 2 r to the fourth times the energy difference, which we're calling epsilon. So without actually doing the full Euclidean field theory, I can get to this, you know, this is sort of more about understanding how the argument goes. So now I say, make that stationary, that energy difference stationary with respect to R. So I differentiate with respect to R. I get 6 pi squared R squared sigma, and it's minus 2 pi squared epsilon R cubed, and that equals 0 for R is 3 sigma on epsilon. So this gives me a radius, and as long as that radius is reasonably big, I kind of believe this argument. And my action is then pi squared R0 cubed on 2 into 4 sigma minus epsilon R0, which is 27 pi squared on 2 sigma to the 4th on epsilon cubed. So what I've done there is just replaced the value of R0. Now, if you go in and you calculate the actual Euclidean solution, so the solution to the Euclidean equations of motion, so how would you put it in full? So here, rho squared is tau squared plus x squared. So this would be the Euclidean equations with that potential ignoring the epsilon bit, which is assumed small, so it's dominated by the double well. And then you can actually approximately solve that analytically by assuming that your configuration in rho is quite sharp around some R naught, which is sort of much bigger than, I guess, 1 over root lambda eta it would be, wouldn't it?
So it's phi is a function, or is it phi times phi squared minus eta squared?
You're solving for phi, the field.
But here, is this phi is a function of phi squared minus eta squared?
No, phi is a function of rho.
Okay, so is it just a multiplication then?
No, that's dv d phi. This is roughly dv d phi. And that was the v up there.
Okay.
Yeah, this is just the Euclidean equations of motion. For that's when you solve, if you have a Lagrangian, your scalar Lagrangian, your Euclidean equations of motion, or actually your equations of motion for the scalar, would be box phi is dv d phi. So that's dv d phi. And so it's a nonlinear, you know, you can see it's a nonlinear equation. And there is, you know, when I was talking about walls in, you know, domain walls, think, you know, things that look like brains, this is a bit like one of those kinks. It's a bit sort of like tanh of, you know, rho minus r root lambda eta sort of thing. And as long as that's a good approximation, that's just basically solving that equation. And when you do that, you get this result over here.
Yeah. First, I have a question. Is there any reason why, considering the case that true vacuum is inside the wall and false vacuum is outside? Because, of course, the calculation will be the same, but I think we should start from true vacuum.
So you mean up tunneling? That's really what you're saying. I mean, for sure, a false vacuum could suddenly fluctuate into existence, but that would, you know, that would generally recollapse. That's sort of not as much of a, you know, that's an even more, to my mind anyway, much more unlikely process, because if you follow, I'm just about to say what happens if you follow this through into real time. What happens is as soon as you form this bubble, it expands. So let me just note that there. So what was a Euclidean bubble? Becomes a hyperboloid in Lorentzian space-time. And so as soon as the bubble is formed, it starts to expand. And so, you know, the lowest, and it, you know, things always want to minimize energy. And so the lowest energy state, it'll try and go there. And so this is a sort of picture where eventually bubbles form and they sort of eat up all of the false vacuum. But that wouldn't happen with an up tunnel.
Now you're in 1+4 dimension?
No, that's 4 dimensions, but on the left is the Euclidean 4 dimensions, and on the right is Lorentzian. And so this is here, we would be in phi equaled phi false vacuum, and inside the hyperboloid, you'd be in the true vacuum.
Yeah, but I was wondering why the volume is proportional to the r to the 4.
Because it's 4 dimensional, we're 4 space-time dimensions.
Including the time.
Yeah, so we go to Euclidean space, tau x.
Okay.
So in four dimensions, but they're now 4 Euclidean dimensions, yeah? So our bubble is now a 3-sphere, and so it has its area is r cubed, and its volume is r to the fourth. Yeah, that's why.
Wait, you said it wouldn't happen that it would expand, or
no? This is our standard false vacuum bubble. So, I mean, you know, whereas a bubble of false vacuum could always nucleate. It's not going to suddenly expand and take over because that's not energetically consistent. Mm-hmm. So.
The true vacuum could expand.
Yeah, because it's got lower energy. So in essence, what's happening is the energy that was inside is encoded in the wall. And then the picture is that these bubbles collide and you sort of get a full transition to the true vacuum, whether, you know, picture. Okay, so moving on, this is just a picture in with no back reaction. But we know that, I mean, you've just spent 4 weeks with me and I don't know, 5 weeks, whenever, with whoever, I don't know who taught the first. It was Luis, wasn't it? You know, hearing about how energy gravitates. So, you know, we really have no business talking about instantons in a sort of infinite space, right? And of course, Coleman knew that. And then he worked with Frank de Lucia to see how you added gravity to this picture. And so I'm going to sort of, again, highlight the key stages of this. We have our false vacuum energy, which we now interpret as a lambda. So our lambda would be 8 pi g epsilon. And this is going to give us de Sitter. And I'm just going to focus on one example. I'm going to tunnel from positive vacuum energy to zero vacuum energy. But of course, you can tunnel from any to any. But this is the one I'm going to focus in on because it's easier to draw. Okay, so Euclidean de Sitter is actually a sphere. Because remember, de Sitter spaces or anti-de Sitter spaces are constant curvature spaces. And so our Euclidean space is an S4. With radius L, which is inversely proportional to the square root of this energy difference. So this is de Sitter. And then, of course, flat space is just flat. So this is the plus, if you like, and this is the minus inside of the bubble. So what I'm going to do here is just show you how what Coleman and De Lucia did. But what they're doing is they're saying that you know, you have your bubble. So if this is the bubble, the minus side is lambda true vacuum, the plus side is lambda false vacuum. So outside you have De Sitter space, so you have to have something that looks like this S4. Inside you're in flat space, so this is just the inside of a ball in four-dimensional space. So the bubble wall so we talked about this when we talked about submanifolds. So our idea is that we're going to have a plus manifold, a minus manifold. The wall is between them. The bubble wall sits at this radius r, which is rho naught in this space-time, and it is l sine chi naught in that space-time. So we're matching at a fixed chi or fixed rho, so these factors have to agree, because we have to match across a manifold that is the same on either side. So my normals on the plus side, my n plus is 1 over L d by d chi. My n minus is just d by d rho. My extrinsic curvature, k plus, is just 1 over L gamma chi alpha beta, which is minus cot chi naught over L, let's call it H alpha beta to be strict. So this is looking, just saying, you know, what's the derivative of, you know, what's the covariant derivative of this normal? Well, it's only the connection components that are parallel to the three sphere. And over here, k minus is again gamma rho alpha beta, which is 1 over rho naught h alpha beta. So you see that it's similar on each side in that, you know, it's just the connection coefficients, but they look different because of the different geometry. So putting this into Israel equations, and you have to also Euclideanize those. So remember, rho naught is L sine chi naught, so I can pull out an L sine chi naught from each bit, and I just get 1 minus cos. So these are my Israel equations, and what they do is they relate the energy of the wall to this value of chi naught here. So roughly speaking, just to see if this, just sort of always when you write stuff down, you always give yourself a reality check. Let's just think what happens as sort of sigma goes to naught. That means that really the, you know, the sort of kink in the geometry should be getting smaller. And so here, as sigma goes to naught, you kind of expect chi naught to go to naught. In other words, the bubble to go away, and that sort of works because this is like chi naught squared on 2, and that goes like chi naught. So this goes linearly to 0, like chi naught. So given that L is sort of related to epsilon, you can sort of see that chi naught is related to sigma on epsilon, sort of. Okay, so therefore, I have a relation that allows me to find that chi naught in terms of the tension of the wall. Now, in order to find the action, in essence, what we need is the difference between the bubble configuration and the background. So if I sketch what this thing looks like, we started off with a round de Sitter, but then we are truncating it at some chi naught and replacing it with something flat. So here, that's chi naught, if you like. So we've taken our round sphere and we've just chopped the end off and replaced it with something flat. So that's our instanton. That's what it looks like in this coordinate system. And therefore, you can see that if I want to calculate what the action of this is, if I'm taking the action of this geometry, so I'm taking this shape and I'm minusing that shape, that's what I'm doing. So I calculate that geometry and subtract the round one.
Mm-hmm. At the beginning you mentioned like instanton refers to like it just being like an instant, so just like localized in time. How do we see this?
So it's easier to see here because this is where you've got sort of R4. So here, this is your Euclidean time, and this is the rest, if you like. And so if you go down to minus infinity of Euclidean time, you're completely in the false vacuum. So imagine just coming up in Euclidean time, false vacuum, oh, bit of true. All false vacuum, right? So this thing is localized in Euclidean time. So, I mean, it's not strictly an instant because obviously it's got some finite extent, but that's where it kind of comes from. The fact that the things are localized in Euclidean time.
Is this localized in this?
Well, it's sort of, it's a bit more, I think that there's all sorts of little subtleties going on, actually, once you include gravity. But you could think of it as, if you start here, the bottom, you've got your sphere. Here, you've got the bubble. And then eventually, you get back to the sphere again. But it's not an infinite range. But it, in some sense, you know? I mean, as you made it smaller, it would look more like that. So, sort of. I mean, these are all just names that, you know, people gave to things when they were first discovering them and the type of solutions that they were looking at. So, you know, I mean, the bounce is something that we barely use anymore, but it was very much used at the time. Anyway, to calculate the action, you can sort of see that in essence, what you've got, you don't really need to do all of this bit round here, because what you really need is what's happening with the wall and what, you know, the bit that was the rest of the sphere, which corresponds actually quite nicely to this, the cost of the wall and the energy gain. So our bounce action is I instanton minus I background, which is, let me get the instanton bit first. So here, when we subtract off this round bit, the only bit that you know, everything just cancels off except the bit that's vanished. So that's what that last integral is. You integrate the bulk for chi less than chi naught, and then the other bit is essentially taking account of the wall. And so we know what these things are. We've got a fact that this delta k here is 12 pi g sigma. So overall, this is minus 3 over 2 sigma, and then I'm plus 1 sigma. So that gives me minus sigma on 2 times the area of the boundary, which is 2 pi squared r cubed. And then the last bit is 3 over 8 pi g l squared. So this bit here is 2 lambda, and we just related lambda to l squared. And then I've got to integrate the volume element, which is l to the fourth sine cubed chi between naught and chi naught. So those, and that R is, of course, L sine chi naught. So here, I'm going to replace this sigma with, where is it? Oh, it's right there. I'm going to replace the sigma here with an expression involving chi. So I get minus pi squared r cubed 1 minus cos chi over 4 pi g r. And then the second bit now what I've got is I've got everything with in terms of chi or chi naught, causes or sines, and L. And so this boils down to pi L squared over 4g, 1 minus cos chi naught squared. And I can then find out what cos chi naught is in terms of sigma to end up with pi L squared on G . So I end up with an expression that is just in terms of sigma and L. Now we had somewhere over here, this expression here, sigma fourth on epsilon cubed. So do you believe this? Well, first of all, you see that if I set G to zero, so you have to be a bit careful because L is related, can't find it, where is it? L squared is 3 over 8 pi g epsilon, right? So gl squared is finite. But, and so here I've got g cubed right, from this foot g to the fourth on g, l to the sixth. So my g cubed l to the sixth is indeed 1 over epsilon cubed. So you can see that I still have 1 and epsilon cubed. And then I see that gl does indeed go to 0 if I take the Prodl limit. So I just end up with sigma to the fourth and 1 and epsilon cubed. So it does actually go to the same answer as you switch off gravity. So that was the classic calculation of Coleman and Co. in the 80s. Now, what I want to do just for the last few minutes is just talk about some of my own research recently, which is going back to this and kind of changing it by adding a black hole. Because what this is describing is a first order phase transition where your order parameter has a discrete change. And when you look at first order phase transitions in nature, they're rarely clean. They're often very messy, and they're often catalyzed by impurities. And indeed, you know, in any lab system, if you quench something to push it through a phase transition, it'll generally be a bit of a mess. So what we did was we went and looked at these bubbles, but with a black hole. Now, people had done this before, but there was a sneaky little technicality in computing the Euclidean action. So let me just tell you what happens with a black hole. Because you have all the tools to do the calculation. So what you're doing is you're replacing, you've still got a bubble, you still have a wall. Inside you have a lambda minus and a black hole. And outside you have a lambda plus and another mass. Now the picture there is that your before is a Schwarzschild, is a black hole of mass m plus and cosmological constant lambda plus. And your after is this configuration where the wall has radius r. Now, it's more complex potentially because maybe the Euclidean configuration r of tau, you know, is now round a black hole. And of course, as we know, Euclidean black holes are not, this is not real, this is just a picture of what the bubble looks like when it's nucleated. But our Euclidean black hole is the cigar, so our bubble wall might look like this. So it's a very different geometrical problem. However, all that changes is the detail. You can still find a normal, it's just not so straightforward because it's this potential time dependence. And you can find the equation of motion of the wall, you can solve for it, and you can then find the Euclidean action. So in essence, what you find are a sequence of instantons with seed mass m plus, a remnant m minus, and some action b, let's say, of m plus m minus, lambda minus. Now, these two are fixed because that's your true and false vacuum. And so this is your seed. And in essence, what you get are a range of instantons. So you get a range of m of instantons for an m plus. And you can calculate what the action looks like. So what you find is that you get, if I normalize B over the Coleman-De-Lucia action, and this is M plus, you find that you get something like a sort of space of solutions, but only one has unique, this has unique closed action, and that will of course dominate the tunneling. So you get a picture that looks a bit like this, where this is the lowest action. And on this side, m minus is zero on there. And here, r dot is zero. It's a sort of static solution. And the action of the static solutions is the difference in entropies. So it is equal to pi r plus squared minus, if I just ignore g for the moment, minus pi r minus squared. So that is the probability of decay. So what happens is the remnant is slightly less mass than the seed, and therefore the entropy drops. But then when you have a process that drops entropy, you expect that to be Boltzmann suppressed. So this, you know, we got to that through all lots of calculation. You saw how much calculation it was when everything was easy. But this was the sort of central result. And this is quite generic. It's generic across arbitrary dimensions, and even if you start adding Lovelock terms to the process. So that is, you know, that is the sort of result with black holes. It relied on a sort of technicality with integrating over singular instantons. But, you know, it seems to be even, you know, seems to be a correct result. So why is it important? Well, if the Higgs is metastable, it turns out that this is nowhere near, it really goes down right towards zero. So what you find is that if you compare the ratio for decay versus the rate of evaporation of a black hole, it sort of looks like e to the minus m delta m with a prefactor that's very small. and so what you find is that if you have a primordial black hole, then they will seed vacuum decay. So a primordial black hole is just some small black hole that forms in the early universe from a sort of very rare fluctuation. And if they have a mass of around 10 to the 15 grams or less at formation, they will be close to evaporating now. But this probability of tunneling means it's an exponentially suppressed process, the constants in front of the Hawking evaporation are so small that you have this window of opportunity. So normally the evaporation, which is power law in M, it goes like 1 on M cubed the lifetime, you would expect normally that power laws win over exponentials, but they don't always if there's a very small number in the prefactor. So the net result is, if you look at the values, or if the actual running of the Higgs coupling, you find that at least, as maybe, it turns over at very large values of the Higgs field. So there is the possibility that the Higgs vacuum is metastable. And if so, then a primordial black hole that's currently evaporating would seed a vacuum decay. So that's why, you know, this has sort of come back into I think when originally they were sort of saying, oh, you know, the vacuum's metastable, there was this thought, it doesn't matter, because the Coleman calculation said the lifetime was sort of 10 to the 140 years or something. But that the Coleman calculations, your universe is completely smooth, completely featureless. As soon as you start to throw in more complex gravitational impurities, you change the whole balance of the equation. So I'm going to stop there. Well done. We've come to the end of another PSI, Gravitational Physics Review course. So well done for sticking to the end. I hope you enjoyed it. And good luck with whatever you end up doing in your futures.
Thank you.